interested in reaching an agreement.
Borrell talks about an agreement, but critics say the EU has been much too soft on the US. After all, an agreement was reached in 2015. It was endorsed by the UN. Only the US broke the terms of the accord when Donald Trump took Washington out of the deal almost 3 years ago.
With Iran, we'll see what happens.
Analysts say in those 3 years, the EU, as coordinator of the deal, officially called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, failed to stand up to Trump. Representatives from Iran, Russia, China, France, Britain, Germany, and the European Commission are attempting to preserve the accord during negotiations in the Austrian capital. US officials are there on the sidelines of the talks. Given that the nuclear deal is underpinned by UN Resolution 2231, the vast majority of diplomats agree it should be respected.
We are 193 member states of the United Nations. Of course, the United States, as you've rightly pointed out, is a powerful member state, but they are a member state. And so we need to rally the numbers against those that may have different opinions.
Some citizens we've been talking to say Tel Aviv is behind efforts to derail the nuclear agreement.
Israel have interests and Israel are kind of pushing America.
Frankly, what we need is more peace and not more warmongering.
Tehran insists the only way the issue can be resolved is if Washington lifts all of its illegal sanctions. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Imposed more tight restrictions to fight the spread of the coronavirus. Earlier, Turkish president said that the daily lockdown during the first 2 weeks of the holy month of Ramadan will start at 7 p.m. instead of 9 p.m. The lockdown will last till 5 a.m. every day, as the weekend lockdown will continue with stricter measures and more police officers present in the streets to make sure citizens and residents are abiding by the rules. During the weekend, security forces in all 81 provinces were out to make sure people are not violating the lockdown. Tourists are the only ones allowed to be outside during the lockdowns. In Istanbul alone, some 20,000 policemen took part in this campaign. Turkish Interior Minister threatened to punish those who do not respect the rules.
We will be out with our full force. Foreigners with residency permits are also subjected to restrictions and lockdowns, and they have to obey the rules just like others. I have the authority to revoke the residency permits of those who try to exploit the situation, pretending to be tourists. We will not let this happen.
The death toll in Turkey surged last month when restrictions were relaxed. Some blame the people who didn't act responsibly. Others blame the government for taking decisions based on the economic needs of the country rather than what is better for people's health. Analysts believe the government must take stricter measures. However, it is the economic situation that is preventing it from doing so.
The government is doing its best against the pandemic, but unfortunately the cases are rising because the country cannot afford full closure of businesses. Therefore, semi-closure is the only solution, and people must be more responsible.
Turkish Health Ministry said 20 million vaccine jabs have been distributed across the country. This is as Turkey says it has potentially developed a vaccine that just entered the phase of human trials. Turkish Industry and Technology Minister Mustafa Varank has volunteered for the trials. Turkish government wants to welcome tourists again after the holy month of Ramadan. However, many believe it is still too soon for this step, as only 25% of citizens have been vaccinated. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
After mass scenes of a failed security operation against thousands of protesters demanding the expulsion of French ambassador from Pakistan, the public resentment pitched high when the police launched operation against the protesters in the eastern city of Lahore. At the heart of public outrage is the revoking of a 6-month-old agreement by the government with Tehreek-e-Labbaik Pakistan, or the TLP, a political and religious group. The TLP championed the cause to expel French ambassador over repeated incident of blasphemy of Muslim Prophet Muhammad and their official patronage by the French government. The TLP supporters allegedly attacked a police station in Lahore and kidnapped 11 policemen, including a senior official. Later on, the protesters released all the police officials. The police says an oil tanker with over 50,000 liters of fuel was also taken away by the protesters, which caused ripples within the corridors of power of its possible explosion. A strong public reaction once again forced the government to halt its security operation. There were countrywide wheel jam strike and closure of businesses after many opposition parties and other religious groups announced to support the TLP's demand to expel French ambassador.
How long we would put up with incidents like burning of Holy Quran? How long we would put up with blasphemy being committed against our Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him? But now we have decided not to tolerate it any longer.
Alarmed by public backlash, Prime Minister Imran Khan struggled hard in his live address to the nation to calm down public anger.
When Muslim countries stand up together and collectively boycott trade with France over blasphemy incidents, then it would have an impact. I would lead this campaign internationally now to prevent incidents of blasphemy.
Pakistan banned TLP last week, declaring it a terrorist organization in a country where violence against the police has become a norm by almost all major political parties to press their demands.
The government has resumed negotiation with the TLP, which is not ready to settle down on anything short of the expulsion of French ambassador from Pakistan. Now the TLP seems to be on a far more strong footing after a failed security operation against them. Therefore, analysts believe that the government is also running out of options but to withdraw its decision to ban it. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
The factory in the south of Tehran, where a new vaccine named Osvid would be produced within a few months to immune people against the deadly coronavirus. The name is taken from the pharmaceutical company that is developing the vaccine in collaboration with a knowledge-based firm. The joint project will soon be tested on humans to be mass-produced in the capital, Tehran.
Given that the initial phases of the Osvid 19 are completed and the early stages, including the animal phase, were carried out on rats and monkeys successfully, we need to launch this mass production line, and now we are prepared.
I asked the officials whether the formula is imported from other countries or it is indigenous, and this was the answer.
Not even a single word of the 420-page project of the vaccine has been non-native. It's fully developed in Iran. We took samples from the first patients at the beginning of the pandemic. Then it was characterized, inactivated, and cultivated. The job has been a very complicated teamwork and totally indigenous.
Right now, the company is producing the vials, and as the manager said, they can produce up to 6,000 every hour. They also told us that there is a capacity to produce about 20 million doses of the jab in a year. After the official ceremony in which the vial was unveiled, the vice president for science and technology launched the production line.
Within the past few years, very good things have been achieved in the domain of vaccine production in the country. This year, we have several corona vaccines to be mass-produced. This vial production line is a very important infrastructure for other companies that are developing the vaccine.
The Osvid vaccine must be injected in two stages with a three-week interval.
Iran says the second phase of vaccination against COVID-19 will begin in early May, and at this stage, about 15 million people would be vaccinated against the coronavirus. To this end, the country needs about 30 million doses of the vaccine, out of which a great number will be homemade ones. Fuman Abedi, Tehran.
America's longest war in Afghanistan is going to end as Washington has pledged to pull out its forces from the country in 5 months. Apart from other consequences of Washington's war in Afghanistan, casualties caused by the conflict over the past two decades showed that almost 90,000 Afghan and U.S. military forces, more than 70,000 civilians, and over 84,000 terrorists have lost their lives since 2001. The main cause behind such casualties is said to be Washington's failures, including taking the Taliban not so seriously. Although weak presence of Taliban was seen in remote villages of Afghanistan in 2001, it slowly expanded its maneuver area to big cities by launching bomb attacks or complex assaults in and after 2005. The attacks mostly claimed the lives of civilians. In response, Afghan and foreign troops launched more military operations, especially air strikes, increasing human losses in the country. Now that Washington has realized there is no military solution to the Afghan war, U.S. President Joe Biden announced on Wednesday that all U.S. troops will leave the war-torn country by September 11, the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. The Afghan government strongly believes that the Taliban will never be able to take control over the country militarily due to high capabilities of Afghan National Armed Troops in the fight against terrorism.
The Afghan Defense Ministry, in close cooperation with other government bodies, is fully ready to confront the worst-case scenario. Concerns of some international intelligence agencies are because of the security of their own countries. But we are not worried because we are now capable enough to defend our nation.
Meneher also argued that the only way to put an end to bloodshed in Afghanistan is the establishment of a united front by Afghan people without being dependent on foreign players, and convince the Taliban to lay down their arms.
The time has arrived for all Afghans to come together and set aside differences in order to use the ongoing peace process as an opportunity for the country to see peace and stability after decades-long war and violence.
While all players are waiting for the launch of Turkey's summit on the Afghan peace process, the Taliban say they are not willing to attend it because the U.S. violated the terms of the agreement signed between the two in Doha, February last year. Based on the Doha agreement, U.S. military forces have to leave Afghanistan by May 1st. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
A show of military might. Different units of the Islamic Republic of Iran's army paraded the forces' latest military equipment on the National Army Day. In Tehran, commanders of the Army's Air Force, Navy, and Ground Force, as well as senior commanders of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, were present to oversee the event. Ahead of the ceremonies, a message from leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, was read out, where he praised the contributions the Army has made to the security of the country. Army officials say serving the Iranian people is their top priority.
In fact, through these parades, we seek to send messages to our nation. We want to tell our people that we will continue to stand with you to ensure your peace and security, just as we have done over the past four decades.
The parades featured the latest military achievements and weaponry of the Iranian army, including radars, tanks, armored vehicles, and fighter jets. The highlight was the latest drones, missiles, and missile systems that are developed inside the country, including Sayyad and Mirsad missile systems. The Islamic Republic provides for 80% of its defensive needs domestically. Officials say the country owes this to four decades of arms embargoes imposed on the country by the U.S. and its allies.
What we did in the past four decades was to look at the sanctions as an opportunity to rely on our own resources. We discovered new potentials inside the country, and here we are today producing nearly every essential military equipment, from missiles to UAVs. So today, our security is not tied to foreign arms suppliers.
The National Army Day was designated in 1979, following a historic speech by late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini. Back then, he thanked the army for its role in the victory of the Islamic Revolution by announcing its neutrality, as the former Pahlavi regime pushed commanders to suppress the revolution. Every year, this massive parade sends strong messages of security to Iranians and the region. But on top of all the messages, the annual occasion is widely interpreted as the army's renewed support for the Islamic establishment. Where officials say, with or without sanctions, the Iranian armed forces continue to defend the country's sovereignty. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
got debate.
We have made some progress, but there's still a long way to go. That has been the prognosis of the talks pretty much since it began in Vienna. One stance, however, has been held and not changed, and that is Iran's insistence that all sanctions be removed. Meanwhile, the U.S. is still struggling to accept that while it continues with the negotiations. In this edition of the debate, we will look at what these sanctions are and why the U.S. is reluctant to accept what Iran sees as a deal maker or a deal breaker.
Signatories of the Iran nuclear deal end their fifth session in 2 weeks amid efforts to revive the agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. Two working groups have been formed, one to draft a list of measures that need to be taken by Iran and another to outline the sanctions that have to be removed by the U.S. Now a third expert group will be working on the matter of sequence. Iran's lead delegate, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, said that would be the focus of talks when they resume next week.
Next week, the most important question is to talk about the sequence, because we have already talked about measures, and we have now focused more on the question of sequence to make sure that the U.S., who has left the JCPOA, should come back first, should lift all its sanctions first, and then Iran would follow after the verification.
Although no direct talks have taken place between Iran and the U.S., the American delegation has been engaged in discussions with the other parties, including Britain, France, Germany, Russia, and China.
The top priority remains to focus on sanction lifting. In this particular context, the U.S. must lift all its sanctions, may it concern Iran or any third party, in thorough, complete, and straightforward manner.
Before leaving Vienna for Tehran, Araghchi said Iran does not want to prolong the negotiations, but also needs to take the time to work on every single word that's being drafted to come up with a specific formula allowing both Iran and the U.S. to come back to full compliance. Iran says the talks are on the right track and moving forward, but as the EU coordinator put it, there's still a lot of work to be done. Pomalinsky, Vienna.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate, we have Fouad Azadi, university professor and political analyst, who joins us. We also have Said Mohsen Abbas, who's a journalist and political commentator, who joins us from London. I'd like to welcome you both. Fouad Azadi, let me first start with you. Our reporter there ended it with, there's still a lot of work that needs to be done. Another statement that we've heard, we have made some progress, but there's still a ways to go. So we're left confused here, and we're hoping that you could perhaps enlighten us as to what is going on in Vienna and whether there has been progress or not, and in what form or manner.
Right. I don't blame you for being confused. This is a manufactured confusion. The issue is not that complicated. What Iran needs is to be able to sell oil, and Iran needs to get that money inside the country. It's that simple. And the reason the American side is engaging in this type of behavior, making things complicated, confusing things, demanding things that has nothing to do with Iran's nuclear program, is because they don't want to do what I just said. They don't want to let Iran sell oil, and they don't want Iran to be able to get that money back. And their level of dedication to the issue of human rights is at the level of not even allowing Iran to use its own money to buy corona vaccines. And at the same time that they talk about human rights, they engage in this type of anti-human behavior. So unfortunately, in the new U.S. government, we basically see the same war crimes mentality that the U.S. officials get to have once they enter the White House, and probably they have that mentality before and after their White House tenure. And that is the basic problem. So in order not to do what they need to do, which is let Iran sell oil and let Iran get the money, they create this atmosphere of confusion. Unfortunately, we have the European countries that are following that line, and that's why we are at the situation that we are.
Yeah, so, Sayed Mohsen Abbas, you know, we hear what Professor Izzati has said there. At the same time, we know that there's been a number of meetings that have taken place. There are explanations that are given by the Iranian side that basically say the only path for the U.S. is to for rejoining the JCPOA is full compliance, the removal of all sanctions, which includes the Obama-era sanctions, the sanctions restored by Trump, the additional sanctions in the Trump era, labeled as non-nuclear and whatnot. But basically, the U.S. appears that they just want to come back with categorizing the sanctions, dividing the sanctions, maybe keeping the human rights issues that it says Iran is violating, which goes maybe contrary to what our Professor Izzati said, because some understanding there is out there that the U.S. will keep the human rights sanctions, but will maybe allow, we don't know any of this yet, but maybe allow the oil to go through. It's really, again, confusing. Let me hear your take on what is going on.
Well, I think, first of all, I have to contextualize the JCPOA within the actual broad objectives of the United States in the Middle East. And, of course, none of those objectives are ones which the Islamic Republic of Iran is going to comply with. And therefore, the JCPOA becomes really, for me, quite a kind of red herring. It's a sort of a sideshow, a distraction in many ways, because the things that America wants really is regime change. They fundamentally, at the core of their policy, are committed to the Islamic Republic of Iran's government collapsing, and they want to try and impose some sort of secular neoliberal establishment, which would, of course, then comply with everything they do in terms of their global systemic rape and pillage and other one. And that's absolutely clear. There's nothing that's changed on that front. So that's the first thing to note, that they will do nothing which will allow the Islamic Republic of Iran's current government to become more powerful or stronger. So as my colleague pointed out, the oil issue becomes very critical. The financial wheeling and dealing of Iran and its ability to generate funds or operate normally in the economies of the world is central to their pillar of destruction of the current government. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that they don't want any interference by the Islamic Republic of Iran in West Asia in terms of its regional development. So, for instance, Israel has been appointed as their policeman. Israel is the one that is allowed to expand and to overrun and operate through puppet regimes like the Saudis, like, of course, even in Jordan, for instance, in Egypt. All of these regimes, these Arab regimes, have long since been really just proxies of Israel and America. So maintaining that status quo is really important for them. And of course, Iran's independent model, an example, its kind of moral stance on so many issues around fighting for the oppressed and giving people their sovereignty, their independence in that region, genuine sovereignty, all goes absolutely against the Americans. And of course, finally, it's the Iranian technological and other scientific developments, I think, which are really troubling both Israel and America, which are also influencing what they're doing around the JCPOA. So the technological developments largely in the nuclear field, in the ballistic missiles field, and in other drone technology, the military field particularly, troubles them. Of course, Iran's expanded on all sorts of levels in other ways as well, in terms of knowledge and advancing their own capabilities for being self-sufficient. But you see, therefore, what you're seeing with the JCPOA is really just part of a wider, range of problems they have with Iran. on. These problems won't go away by settling the JCPOA, either for Iran or for the United States. So I do rather feel that this is all just an excuse, and the way they're dragging their feet and delaying and making all these complications seems to me to be more of what they've done before, bluff, bluster, and trying to buy time to work out more ways to destroy Iran.
Okay, buying time is something that is one of the red lines, Professor Izadi, that Iran's leader has set for these talks, and I'm sure that the Iran negotiating team is abiding by that, which is led by Abbas Araghchi. But I'm trying to ask from you, Professor Izadi, to again clarify the news that's out there, because there are many who are forming their conclusions or their ideas about what is going on in these talks by what they're hearing in the news. Now, this is one of them that Iran has rejected. The source is saying, according to sources close to European and U.S. negotiators, Mali is expected to offer Tehran a Goldilocks-style deal. This comes from Foreign Policy. Just enough sanctions relief so Iran will return to the pact, but not so much that it would leave Biden vulnerable to attacks from hardliners at home, including those in his own party who oppose any concessions at all to Iran. Iran has rejected that. Why is this? Why is there this type of news that's coming out, do you think?
I think the Biden administration doesn't want to comply with JCPOA. So a few minutes ago, Jake Sullivan talked on a news channel in the United States saying that the United States is interested in compliance for compliance. But when you read these type of news reports and analysis in the American media, you realize that Jake Sullivan and Rob Malley and others that deal with this issue in the U.S. government, they are not telling you the truth. Because if they were really interested in complying with JCPOA, they didn't need to wait 3 months and engage in this type of prolonged negotiations. They could do to JCPOA what they did with the Paris Climate Accord, just issue an executive order the way Biden did in the first week of his presidency, and the United States returned to that accord. And that's when you actually want to comply with an agreement, and that's the way you do it. And if you don't want to comply with an agreement, you start playing around with words, and you create confusion as you asserted your program with that idea. And, you know, saying that we have people in the U.S. Congress that oppose JCPOA, so we are not going to comply with JCPOA, is not an excuse. The internal power struggles in the United States, internal competitions between Republicans and Democrats, is not an Iranian problem. That's an internal issue for the United States. The U.S. Agreed to comply with JCPOA in 2015, said that it's one of the P5 plus one countries that is accepting the terms of JCPOA, and now, after 5 years, with the Trump administration trying to destroy JCPOA, the new administration in Washington suddenly remembers that there are people in the U.S. Congress that don't like JCPOA. So having this type of excuses, I don't think, is going to fly, and Iran's legitimate demand is that the agreement needs to be followed. And they have a choice to follow the agreement, and they can actually do comply with the agreement, and Iran has said that the Iranian government will do the same, or they can make confusion. It's a choice that they have. Either way, I think Iranian government is confident that even without an agreement with the United States, the country can continue to grow and become stronger. And realizing that there is no difference between Republicans and Democrats when it comes to regime change issues, as your guest in London referred to, is going to be quite beneficial for a lot of Iranians that do see a difference between these two parties when it comes to their aim with regard to Iran. They do have differences in how engage in tactics, but in terms of their ultimate goal, I don't see a difference. And that idea is going to be accepted by a lot of people in Iran if the Biden administration continues on the same path that they have started.
Okay, I'm going to come back to you with another piece after I ask our guest Seymour Sinovas my next question, but I'm going to come back to you, Professor Azadi, with another piece of news out there that Iran has rejected in the past 48 hours. Okay, Seymour Sinovas, so a simple question comes out of what you said. If the U.S. is after regime change in Iran, what is it doing at the negotiating table then with at this point with E4? It should just come out, but yet we're seeing these negotiations go on.
Well, by continuing these talks, as I said, what they're going to do is really try to distract, try to slow Iran down, also create confusion, ideally, amongst the Islamic Republic of Iran's population. You see, if you get a debate going by keeping these things, try to make the Islamic Republic of Iran's leadership look perhaps as though it's incalcitrant, it doesn't want to negotiate, and it's bringing hardship on its own people. This is the narrative that they've been pushing by putting the economic sanctions ever more tightly and ever more expansively. They want to try and convince also the grassroots population to say, look, we're fed up of all these sanctions. Why don't we just compromise and go for the deal, which at least gets us back into the American good books? Well, the thing is, the problem with that, of course, is that it won't satisfy the Americans or the Israelis. What you're going to do is you give away one element, and they're going to want more and more and more. This is the nature of the imperialist beast. It's a fact of life that they're looking for the vulnerability and the weakness within Iran. If they were being truly fair, what the Americans would be looking on this table is that Iran is willing to forego its nuclear, even its peaceful nuclear development, essentially. And what they're also getting out of the deal, if they were to go for it, is the fact that actually they haven't been brought into any kind of denuclearization package in West Asia, at least, if not beyond. I mean, what principally should happen is that the Israelis, who have nuclear capability, who are the main problem in the Middle East for peace, are being allowed to have a carte blanche, and they're not being given special JCPOA style deals. Why is that not happening? I mean, of course, Israel is the fundamental problem in that region. They're not being asked to come in front of an inquisition. Why is Iran particularly being picked out? Iran hasn't done anything that really validates even the idea of a JCPOA agreement coming into the equation. Then, of course, there's the proxy, the other proxy, Saudi Arabia. The Americans have given a complete green light to their own nuclear development agencies and corporate companies to go in and actually develop nuclear capability in Saudi Arabia. Those tenders are out. It's public knowledge. So on the one hand, you've got an attitude towards the Islamic Republic of Iran where you're trying to bind them down in a deal which now you've reneged on, walked out unilaterally, and are still dragging your feet and doing economic terrorism as a result of it for your own gains. But on the other side, in the same region, you're allowing nations like Saudi Arabia, who are obviously antagonistic to the Islamic Republic of Iran, you're actually financing and supporting their development of nuclear weapons, potentially. And, of course, the despotic regimes there are not under question.
Okay. So, Professor Azadi, I talked about how I'm going to ask you about the second piece of news out there in the past 48 hours that's come out if you can clarify for us. This comes from Reuters, how it said Iran and world powers have made some progress on how to revive the 2015 nuclear accord, no news there, later abandoned by the U.S., and an interim deal could be a way to gain time for a lasting settlement. And they have said that Iranian officials have said that. Now, Iran's top nuclear negotiator, Abbas Araghchi, has said that there is no discussion on an interim agreement or similar topic in the Vienna talks. What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, one issue that is the elephant in the room is Iran's election, a presidential election in June. And we have this situation internally that there are people who may want to use these type of negotiations as a sort of a winning card in the debates that the country will have when people decide to choose the next president in Iran. So having an interim agreement is going to be attractive on political for political reasons that is in line with the election that is coming up. But I don't think, since you asked my opinion, I don't think this is going to work out. I think, given the experience of JCPOA in 2015, and given the fact that even the Obama administration did not follow JCPOA properly when they were in office until January of 2017, I don't think the Iranian leadership, the country's leadership, will go with a project or a scheme that is designed to basically affect the results of Iran's election. And the result is going to be, if the Americans continue on the current path, is that you are not going to have an agreement, and these talks will fail if the Biden administration continues with its current line of thinking.
Thank you very much for that. It was a pleasure. Fouad Azadi, university professor and political analyst. You answered many questions. We do appreciate that. Of course, Said Mohsen Abbas, your analysis. Thank you very much. Journalist and political commentator there from London. Many thanks to you both. And that does it for this edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Vitaly, the entire team here in the capital, Tehran is goodbye.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Systematic racism is the fuel that drives police violence against black people, and we must cast aside any talk of accidents when it comes to matters of racially motivated violence, says Marjorie Kahn, writer, in an article titled, U.S. Supreme Court is also to blame for Don't Wright's death. Stay tuned for the details, please. When veteran Minnesota police officer Kimberly Potter, who is white, stopped Don't Wright, a 20-year-old black man, for an expired registration tag, she committed an act of racial profiling. As a result, Wright's blood is on the hands not only of Potter, but also of the U.S. Supreme Court, which has legally sanctioned this type of racial profiling. Like Derek Chauvin, who is on trial for killing George Floyd, Potter is not an exception to the rule. Both are typical representatives of a system of racist, violent law enforcement against black people. When Potter shot and killed Wright, her act, whether intentional or accidental, was also grounded in the same sort of racism manifested by officers throughout the United States. Potter killed Wright quickly, unlike Chauvin, who tortured Floyd to death over a period of 9 minutes and 29 seconds. After she stopped Wright, Potter found he had a warrant out for his arrest for a misdemeanor. When the officers tried to arrest him, Wright pulled away to get back in the car. Potter pointed her gun at Wright, threatened to taser him, and then shot him. The overreaction of both Potter and Chauvin to relatively minor offenses led to the murders of two unarmed black men. Why? When you stop people of color, do you automatically draw a weapon? Asked Pastor Ezra Fag Tett, an eyewitness to Wright's death. Although Potter may have had probable cause to believe that Wright committed a minor traffic infraction, her decision to stop him was also the result of racial profiling. In 1996, Antonin Scalia wrote an opinion for unanimous Supreme Court that legalized racial profiling during traffic stops. The court authorized pretext stops in Wren v. United States. That means officers can stop cars and temporarily detain motorists on the pretext of enforcing traffic laws, even if a reasonable officer would not have stopped the driver absent some additional law enforcement objective. Even if they are subjectively motivated by racism, officers can stop a car as long as they have probable cause to believe the driver committed a traffic infraction. Wren permits reasonable law enforcement objectives to serve as a pretextual justification for subjective suspicion on the basis of race. Pretext stops foster racial profiling and ultimately the use of violence against black people. Living in a society steeped in white supremacy, non-black people in the U.S. often associate blackness with criminality and violence. The participants in a 2017 study conducted by the American Psychological Association believe that the black men were more capable of causing harm in a hypothetical altercation, and troublingly, that police would be more justified in using force to subdue them, even if the men were unarmed. Lead author John Paul Wilson said, non-black participants were more likely to view the black men as more harmful. More than a quarter of police killings in 2018 occurred during traffic stops, according to a study conducted by National Public Radio. Officers' use of force is not proportionate to level of risk they are faced with during these traffic stops. Legal scholar Jordan Blairwitz found that the rate for a felonious killing of an officer during a routine traffic stop was only 1 in every 6.5 million stops. Likewise, the rate for an assault resulting in serious injury to an officer was just 1 in every 361,111 stops. Yet black men were killed at a rate of 31.17 per every 1 million stops, a report by ProPublica concluded. Tasers can also kill people. Potter is claiming that she intended to reach for her taser, but accidentally grabbed her gun instead. Before shooting Wright, Potter screamed, "Taser!" Even if Potter did intend to taser Wright, that still would have amounted to the use of excessive force. Tasers are electrical weapons that deliver pulses of electrical charge that cause the subject muscles to contract in an uncoordinated way, thereby preventing purposeful movement. This effect has been termed neuromuscular incapacitation, according to the 2020 UN guidance on less lethal weapons in law enforcement. The charge is delivered through metal probes that are fired towards the subject, but which remain electrically connected to the device by fine wires. Officers regularly use tasers despite their lethal nature. While police ostensibly seek compliance from victims by utilizing tasers, they render victims unable to respond to commands due to neuromuscular incapacitation. There is a pattern of disproportionate use of deadly force by tasering black people. A Reuters survey on TASER-related deaths through 2018 concluded that of 1,081 people who have died in the U.S. from the use of TASERs, at least 32% were black, even though black people comprise only 14% of the population. But although 29% of people killed by TASERs were white, 60% of the U.S. population is white. U.S. officers are rarely held accountable for killing black people. Mapping police violence reported in 2020, officers were charged with a crime in only 1% of all killings by police. Most officers who are charged are not convicted. And in the few cases they are convicted, it is frequently for lesser charges, not murder. The timing of her killing of Wright made Potter's prosecution more likely. Tensions in Minneapolis and indeed throughout the nation are high as video clips of Chauvin crushing the life out of Floyd are broadcast repeatedly throughout Chauvin trial. The justifiable public outrage at Potter's shooting of Wright led to quick resignations of Potter and the Brooklyn Center Police Chief. Prosecutors charged Potter with second-degree manslaughter, which carries a maximum of 10 years in prison. In Minnesota, second-degree manslaughter is defined as causing the death of another by culpable negligence whereby the person creates an unreasonable risk and consciously takes chances of causing death or great bodily harm to another. But Ben Crum, attorney for the Wright family, stated this was no accident. This was an intentional, deliberate, and unlawful use of force. He said, "You would think that you know what side your gun is on and what side your taser is on. There was no need to even tase him." Crum cited implicit bias that goes beyond policy. Wright's aunt, Nisha Wright, wants Potter charged with murder. "Prosecute them like they would prosecute us," she said at a news conference. "We want the highest justice." Prosecutors are likely doubtful they could get a jury to convict Potter of murder, second-degree murder, which can result in a 40-year prison sentence, is defined as causing the death of another with an intent to kill. Third-degree murder carries a maximum sentence of 25 years. In order to be convicted, the perpetrator must have caused the death of another by an act eminently dangerous to others and evincing a depraved mind without regard for human life. Potter is a former president of her police union. These unions often assist members in covering up their misconduct. Police union representatives frequently provide officers with false narratives to conceal their culpability. Officers routinely meet with union representatives and lawyers before they officially submit a statement. Racism drove each of the steps that led to Wright's murder, from Potter's stop of Wright to her pulling out her gun, to her threatening to fire a taser at him, to finally shooting Wright dead. Systematic racism is the fuel that drives police violence against black people in the U.S., and we must cast aside any talk of accidents when it comes to matters of racially motivated violence.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.